Now, however, we're lucky to have as this year's Sir Howard Kippenberger Fellow in New Zealand, Dr. Raja Mohan. Dr. Mohan is a leading authority on India's foreign policy and has recently been the Henry Kissinger Scholar in Foreign Policy and International Relations in Washington. He has a master's degree in nuclear physics and a PhD in international relations, the perfect combination. He's had numerous roles as a defence analyst and as a high-profile strategic affairs editor for the Indian Express, and he's the author of several books on Indian foreign policy, including, in 2006, Impossible Allies, Nuclear India, United States and the Global Order. The other day in Wellington, he delivered the Kippenberger Memorial Lecture, in which he focused on the emergence of China and India as the two elephants in the Asian drawing room and the implications this has for the rest of us in the region and beyond. And Raja Mohan has agreed to come and tell us more. Good morning.
Morning.
Are the two elephants likely to bump each other more aggressively in future?
They'll certainly bump into each other a lot more. In fact, ever since they became independent, they've kind of had difficulties finding a balanced relationship.
Hmm.
There were territorial disputes because once China came into Tibet, India had a new neighbor. And the problem of how to define the boundary, the problem of Tibet's relationship to India and China,
mm-hmm.
they've been major issues. Then China's relationship with Pakistan, India's objected to the nuclear cooperation between the two of them. And then they also had differences in terms of how to think about Asia and how to think about the world. But at this point, while many of those differences have been kind of dampened, they've not been removed. Meanwhile, the new thing, like rest of Asia, India's own economic interaction with China has grown significantly.
Mm.
The trade is likely to hit $100 billion in the next 3 years. But at the same time, the political difference, whether it is in terms of their values, or competing different political systems, and an inevitable, jockeying for position in different parts of Asia. That's real and that exists. And the old problems, the boundary dispute, Tibet question, have not gone away either.
No. Does India have what you might regard as a natural advantage in its democracy, its plurality, and what have you, over China? I mean, if you look at the immediate term, is this an advantage?
Most people have thought it was a disadvantage.
Really?
Most probably the Chinese think, too, it's a disadvantage. And the sense that democracy and development don't go together, that's been a fairly common and widespread notion in large parts of Asia.
Say
if you're a Lee Kuan Yew or if you're a Deng Xiaoping,
yeah.
you would have said, look, you want democracy, look at India and where India is.
A little bit of benign dictatorship development.
The idea that focused, purposeful states, even if they're authoritarian, are useful at the initial stages of development, that has a stronghold in many parts of Asia. But what's interesting that's happened is in the last 10 years, India's rapid economic growth is about to disprove this thesis.
Hmm.
That if India succeeds as an economy and becomes the third largest economy in the next 20 years, then you can say, look, democracy and development are not in opposition to each other. So India,
and there are economists in the Western world who will dance on that. Yes.
But at this point, I think the what we're seeing is that democracy provides a safety valve that by letting differences be aired all the time and resolved through competing in a competitive political environment.
Yes.
While you see in China now, just the mention of a protest, there were no protesters, hardly any, and the journalists who went to cover the non-existent protests were actually quite handled badly. So China cannot afford even one demonstration today.
No.
Well, India, there are million mutinies as been said, you know, is going on continuously.
Well, that's why I say, is there a natural advantage?
I think it's an advantage, and it's an advantage of the longer term.
Yeah.
But in the shorter term, as you know, democracies are not, they take longer time producing domestic consensus. So the pace of economic reforms is slower, and the pace of reorganization in foreign policy. Democracies are known to be incompetent in national security and foreign policy. So there are disadvantages as well.
I just want to focus on China a little bit more because there are signs, quite interesting signs of unrest. And yes, it's quite clear that the Chinese are not in a position to really countenance too much of this. There are rising costs. There are hints already now of declining competitivity in the world marketplace, which nobody was talking about two or three years ago, and which clearly worry them a lot. And I guess people are going to watch China in this respect as their growth perhaps tails off slightly and India's accelerates and say, hey, how about some more democracy? Is that... Are we likely to see that divergence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think while China is beginning to have problems, we must acknowledge one fact. I mean, that's an empirical reality, that in the last 30 years, China has done remarkably well. This is probably the single largest improvement in the lives of the largest number of people in the shortest period of time. Many people who thought communist parties cannot build capitalism. In a sense, the Chinese red capitalism, shall we say, disproved that point. But I think it's reached a point now where many of the contradictions in the system are going to present themselves. For example, in China has still not been able to separate the party and the state.
Yes.
Do
they want to?
Yeah, they can't. I mean, I think the problem is their model does not allow separation of the party and the state. But if you don't do it, how are you going to accommodate divergent interests that are going to come in the society, especially when you have a large middle class that's growing, or when there is a conflict between the party boss in a small town who's selling off land to his friend who's the businessman? I mean, where is the justice for those who are affected? So there's no still an effective court system.
And those who are affected will know more and more because of the communications revolution.
Yeah. So it's going to be how China resolves this is going to be the big question for the world in the coming years. And secondly, China also has to change its economic model.
Yeah.
The China today sits on a foreign exchange surplus of nearly $2 trillion. It's got a trade of $2.9 trillion last year. And how long can China be the exporter and the rest of the world will merely absorb the Chinese exports? So China will have to reorganize its society, that is shifting it from exports to domestic consumption.
Yes.
That would mean fundamentally redoing the model. And I think that is going to create problems as well.
This is another long march.
Absolutely.
The more liberalism, more plurality in the wider Asian region means less certainty, less stability. What does this mean for India? Several years ago, you wrote that India is on the verge of becoming a great power and a swing state in the international system. What did you mean by the swing state?
Yeah. See, on the one hand, you have the rise of China, and it's already the number two economy. It becomes the number one economy, say, in the next 20 years. Along with this economic growth, there's going to be military power that's going to come with it. So the rise of China is going to fundamentally alter the structures in the world. Now, meanwhile, India is growing at 8%. India is moving slowly, but the fact is, if India continues to grow at 8%, it too will have the military capacity to influence the balance of power.
Yes.
And then India, as a leading democracy outside the West, is in a critical position in terms of how we think about the future of the values we share. So therefore, whether it is a question of political systems, the nature of the political systems, whether it is a question of economy or the military balance, a strong India can tilt the scales between competing powers or competing ideas.
Well, is India strong enough to do that now?
It's growing, and I think it's getting there. And the fact that both George Bush and Obama have reached out so much to India is based on the bet that India is going to grow, India's power will grow, and India can make a difference to how the international system is organized in the coming years.
I suppose an interesting question here is that do markets follow hearts and minds, for want of a better expression, in Asia? In other words, India's growing sphere of influence, including the conclusion of free trade agreements with ASEAN and with South Korea,
Japan, as well.
Which is a dramatic change in the overall approach. India is now well seated, well placed to exploit huge market opportunities in Asia, possibly even better than China.
There are two things. I mean, we must remember the two important facts. One is geography. China is in the center of East Asia, the dynamic part, and China has maritime boundary with Japan. It has land boundaries with so many different countries. So in some senses, you have China as the natural center of East Asia. But India is the center of the Indian Ocean region. But at the same time, so there are that India cannot match China, you know, dollar to dollar in East Asia. But India's overall footprint in East Asia will grow. India's footprint in Indian Ocean will grow. So it's going to be slightly differently oriented. But there's no question that the footprints of China and India are going to overlap in Asia. And managing that that friction that will arise out of the overlapping footprints between China and India is going to be the problem. India has opportunities. But I don't think India is in competition with China in that sense. For example, it can never match the China-Japan relationship.
Yeah. Where are the big markets, though? Are they in East Asia or further south in future?
Yeah, I think further south in the future because India has not grown in many decades. So therefore, the potential for growth is much larger in India. And that's why most people, and the demographic dividend too, works in favor of India. As China begins to age, India is going to have the largest workforce in the next 20 years. So India's potential and its promise are huge. And for the first time, we have a sense of optimism in India. If you went back to the 50s, the 60s, or even the 70s and the 80s, the general assumption not only of the world, but of the Indians was that, look, we're not going to make it. But the last 20 years of reform has transformed India in terms of the optimism about its own future. And you see Indian entrepreneurs, Indian businessmen today across the world making a big difference. And unlike in China, where the state-led enterprises, cheap money, they're going all over the world. But in India, it is the private sector. It is the Indian entrepreneurs who are going and doing things on their own. So this is a model that is significantly different from the Chinese presence in the world.
What has this meant for the state sector in India? Because it was a very centralized kind of country for a very long, since independence.
Absolutely.
With the state effectively providing the impetus, the state being the largest investor and all of that. That is effectively reversed in the space of, 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I would say the last 20 years. I mean, I think the reforms started in 1991. They really acquired a momentum only in the last decade. So I would say over the last decade, the capacity of the Indian private sector has dramatically increased. And unlike in China, where the state kind of has boosted these enterprises, in India, the capital had to survive what you pointed out, the state socialism of decades. So they know better to work under adverse conditions, have learned how to produce the maximum in terms of the what economists call capital input and the output. So they're far more tuned into producing the maximum results with the minimum inputs.
I'm talking to Dr. Roger Mohan, the Howard Kippenberger Memorial Fellow in New Zealand at the moment. India is seeking a wider sphere of influence in the Indian Ocean and probably beyond, down to this region. That involves a naval presence, and that has been building up enormously. The Chinese have established port facilities in friendly countries and a whole range of, including even some tariff-free zones or economic zones, special economic areas or whatever they call them. Is that the same route that India will follow? Creation of port facilities for the Indian Navy right round the Indian Pacific, Ocean, Indo-Pacific area?
Yeah, I think if you look at the map, what you see is that China that is oriented to the Pacific and central to the Pacific, and in India that is oriented towards the Indian Ocean and at the very, very heart of it. The fact today is China and India are not only becoming regional powers. They're also becoming global powers.
Mm.
So when we say global power, it means China's interests are not limited to the Pacific. So they're going to say, look, our energy comes from the Gulf. Increasingly, our resources are going to come from Africa. Therefore, China has a vital interest in the Indian Ocean. So China is going to build its presence in the Indian Ocean. Similarly, India's own interests in the Pacific are going to grow. Today, it is, as you referred to, the free trade agreements that we've signed. And increasingly, India's trade is now not oriented to the West, but to the Pacific. Mm. So India is going to do things in the Pacific. But I think how India is going to do this, I believe, is going to be different from how China has done. China has gone out, established bases, or trying to establish ports, etc. I think India's strategy is to work in a coalition with the United States and Japan,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully someday Australia, and hopefully New Zealand. But the emphasis has been not to set up independent basing facilities, but to increase its interaction with the major powers, as well as step up its security cooperation with Vietnam, mm-hmm. with Indonesia, with Singapore. But so far, India has not acquired any bases, and unlikely they would want to acquire that kind of a facilities which today are politically controversial in most countries.
It's interesting. Somebody recently said, another Indian commentator said, India used to favour extending the maritime perimeters, of coastal states. In other words, let's seal off the yeah. areas that we're likely to be in control of. But India now speaks of the freedom of the seas as global commons that need to be protected for international trade and movements and so on. This is a huge step beyond the old Nehru-dominated foreign policy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the third world attitude, I mean, was that you're weak states, and since as newly independent powers,
take what you got,
and you consolidate your territoriality.
Yes.
And when the law of the sea came, most of the developing countries said, look, we need to extend our territorial limit as much.
Developing countries. It rings true here.
But the difference was, unlike advanced countries, most developing countries didn't have the capacity to actually police or monitor their own extended economic zones. But I think the transformation you referred to, that India today talks about commons, is the fact that India is beginning to emerge as a maritime power.
Hmm.
See, maritime powers have global interests, and maritime powers want open sea lanes. So the attitudinal change in India is one of previously claiming more maritime territory to one today saying that what we need is open sea lanes, that the maritime commons should be open to all, and that India would contribute to the managing of these commons.
Mm-hmm.
While the Chinese attitude is different. I mean, while the Chinese, if you see, they claim the whole South China Sea is theirs.
Yes.
The Chinese are still in the phase, while China is a bigger power and will have bigger maritime interests, their attitude has been defined so much by territorial consolidation, whether
yes.
it is the claims for Taiwan
right.
or it is the claims in South China Sea.
And the Chinese, there's an awful lot of posturing goes on. I mean, a couple of large warships steams into a port or sails through a strait somewhere, and oh my God, you know, what does this mean? And that will intensify, inevitably. That will intensify in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific.
Absolutely. I think traditionally China has been seen as a land power oriented towards the continent. Its threats were largely inside. And for the first time today, China has become a gigantic trading nation. As I said, you know, it depends on exports. So as China becomes a principal force in the global economy, fully integrated into it, China is bound to become a maritime power.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question about it. So I think this idea that we must criticize China's intentions. And I think that is wrong. I mean, I think the reality is the world's second largest economy with a long coastline will build a powerful navy. And they're going to operate as far as possible. They will come to the South Pacific Islands, they come to New Zealand, they go to the southwestern Indian Ocean. That's what the U.S. does, right? I mean, So I think the Chinese are going to do it. The question for us is not objecting to the Chinese maritime profile that is rising, but to saying, look, will China be a responsible maritime power? And will it help contribute to the commons? Or will it want to dominate the seas? That is the political issue. So how do we get China to be a responsible is responsible player in the managing of the global commons. That is the real issue.
And the side issue of this is, because the Americans see this as crucial, where does India fit in the United States' view of how this global management will take place? Clearly, the visit by Obama recently to Delhi was designed to as a vote of confidence in India in this broad responsibility.
Absolutely. I think when Bush offered this nuclear deal to India, there was a lot of criticism in the U.S.
Just tell us about that. I mean, why did that happen then? Was it essentially Afghanistan-related?
No, it was not Afghanistan-related. It was really the largely non-proliferation-related.
Okay.
Many of the arms controllers, the democratic foreign policy establishment, they said, look, you're cutting a special deal with India means you're undermining...
This was a deal to provide nuclear materials.
Yeah. On the civilian side. Okay. But since India was not a party to the NPT, it was said, look, India can't be given these things. So what Bush did was to carve out an exception for India.
Yeah.
And the others, the Democrats and the arms controllers said, look, this is not the right thing to do. And in fact, even New Zealand had a similar position. But at that time, we thought, once Bush goes, it is possible that Obama, catering to the more liberal internationalist segment of the party, will not carry forward with the deal. But he did. He implemented the deal that Bush made.
Yes.
And it looks like as U.S. comes to terms with the rise of China, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, they see India as a valuable partner in constructing both a stable balance of power in Asia as well as new global rules on the international system.
What was there a debate in India about this? Because this was effectively a rapprochement with the United States. India's foreign policy history had been very independent, had been very sealed off from the West. It had been very non-aligned. It had been almost in bed with the Russians for quite a long time. Was there a debate about this, or was it simply decided this is where we have to go and trust us, we know what we're doing?
It's been a very, very big debate. And in fact, when Bush offered us the deal, most people thought it was a free gift, a gift horse. But Indians decided to look at it in its mouth for almost 3 years. Because there were strong views on the left in India. So, look, is this a trap? Are we being taken for a ride? Why is the U.S. being nice to us? So it took a long time to convince people that, look, this is not... India is not surrendering its independent foreign policy. India will not have to surrender its autonomy, strategic autonomy. So that debate had to go through. In fact, the Prime Minister had to convince the people quite hard. And in fact, he had to introduce a confidence motion in the parliament to get the deal through.
He has no doubts at all. Manmohan Singh has no doubts about this.
I think if you think of India, as you said, we used to vote against the West more often than the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Because there were some issues at least where the US and Russia were working together. And people used to say, look, anti-Americanism is very much part of India's mental makeup. But people forget that India was also a Western country.
Yes.
That it was only democracy outside the West. It had no real quarrel with the West, but for Pakistan and the Cold War issues. So when India opened up its economy, an India that was closed, had nothing to do with trade, it was not interested in making money, and its whole thing was focused on self-reliance. But once you opened up your economy, and we changed our economic strategy from self-reliance to globalization, it naturally opened up the room for working with the United States and the West. And I think that's why Bush was prescient in looking ahead and saying that, look, we need to remove the remaining obstacles, political obstacles, for cooperation with India. So both on the nuclear issue as well as on the Kashmir issue, Bush took positions that were very supportive of India. And I think that opened the door for India rethinking its policy. But it was a painful process.
Is there pressure now on India to relent a little bit on Kashmir?
No, in fact, when Mr. Obama came to Delhi, in fact, the few months before that, there was quite a bit of tension in Kashmir. But he was under a lot of pressure to say remarks, either pressing India to do certain things. He didn't. So I think the Americans realized that, look, on that here is a democracy struggling to get things right, and that you should give that space for India to resolve its problems rather than trying to lecture India.
And President Obama made a very interesting announcement that he would support India's case for a permanent seat on the Security Council of the United Nations. I mean, in other words, UN restructuring. Yeah. Yes, India should be in there. Has anything happened on that?
Nothing is going to happen on that. No. I think it was a
yes.
It was a freebie.
Easy to say.
Yeah, it is easy to say, and it's surprising they took so long saying it because it's a check that can't be cashed.
But have they been saying it to the Brazilians and others?
They've said it, and they've been saying this, but I don't see how it can be done because the Russians and the Europeans, the British and the French are not going to let go their domination. China is not going to want India in the Security Council. So therefore, I don't see it happening anytime soon. But what is important for India is that as long as it grows at a high rate, becomes a major power, it does not matter whether we sit in the Security Council or not. Because international institutions will reflect eventually the power realities and not the other way around.
The G20 membership provides a buffer for that in the short run, I guess, and may, even in the long run, almost replace the... Heaven forbid, the Security Council, except in moments of great emergency.
Yeah.
So that's headed in the right direction. President Obama also struck a couple of boom notes, one over Myanmar. And he seemed to be maintaining that India should do more to try to create democracy in Myanmar, which was interesting when you consider how the Americans... my enemy's enemy is my friend, and there's a long history of that. But anyway, he was saying that, and he was offering some other. In fact, he was also saying that you ought to be more liberal in terms of agricultural trade, which a number of New Zealanders would describe as pot calling kettle black. Yeah. But anyway, how much of a problem are these two issues?
No, I think on democracy issue, I think the emphasis that Obama puts, saying that, look, India should do more to help democracies, should help people who are struggling on the streets to stand with them for their democratic rights. That lecture is fine because, Burma is far away from the United States and it's easy to take a pure position. But what we've seen in the Middle East in the last few weeks tells you it's not so easy. When your interests are linked, that today it took a long time for Obama to come out and say, look, we are with the people of Egypt and not with Mubarak. And right now, they're hesitating a lot to come out in support of the Libyans. Or, in fact, the reports in the last 2 days in the U.S. press saying that, look, the policy is quite simple now, which is regime change where your enemies are involved, like probably Libya, and reform, perhaps gentle encouragement where your allies are concerned, like in Bahrain. So I think I'm not, it's like...
In 20 years' time, India might be doing exactly the same thing, right?
Absolutely.
And making exactly the same pragmatic...
Absolutely. I think
unpleasant decisions.
I think all major powers have to reconcile the tension between their values and their interests. And where your interests are less, it's easy to take a high-minded principled positions, but where your interests are involved, it gets a lot more difficult. But I think India will struggle through with this. Like the U.S., whatever happens, there's always this voice for promoting democracy. Similarly, in India, too, the sense, how does India reconcile its democratic values to its foreign policy? That's an issue that will become more live, I think, in the Indian debate.
India's foreign policy has had a very interesting history. Immediately after independence under Nehru, it was kind of pro-Asia. There was a Asian unity was like African unity, I suppose, in the same way. The flush of enthusiasm for that, but it didn't last. And a lot of people in this part of the world ask, what is Asia going to represent in the middle of the 21st century? Will it become another flashpoint? Will we see more when the two elephants begin to sort of tusk each other? Will we see some real conflict? And clearly, for a country like this one, we need to know some answers on that.
Yeah. I think the two issues, man. I think one, you're absolutely right that for Nehru, Asian unity, Asian solidarity were very important. They were part of our national movement because when India was becoming independent, It also discovered that the huge relationships, historical, civilizational, with the rest of Asia. So it's the first diplomatic initiative was to actually convene a conference of Asian nations. And then we had the Bandung Conference in Indonesia in 1955, where Chou En-lai came for the first time and addressed the Asian leaders. What we saw happen in Bandung was really that Asia was too divided, yeah. That for all the aspirations to come together, there was even talk about an Asian federation, Asian, you know, economic integration. But the fact was the China and India turned inwards soon afterwards.
Yes.
They became socialist, they became communist. And
people
then
say that Zhou En-lai didn't mean anything that he said.
Yeah, he said all the right things.
Hmm.
But by 58, you had the Great Leap Forward and the, yes, Cultural Revolution, and, yes, China was headed in a different direction at home.
Yes.
So there was very little China could do outside. And in fact, it did wrong things like promoting revolutions in different parts. India turned inward and was not interested in economic engagement. But many of the ideas of the 50s of Asian Federation, Asian integration today have become real. Because,
yes,
as China and India now turn outward, grow, they're going to integrate the rest of the region. So in some senses, the old ideas have come true, but in a very different context.
So for India, the next 10 years or so will be a diplomatic charm offensive.
Absolutely. And I think there's so much work to be done, so much more in terms of what it, you know, engagement, expanding economic relationships. For example, India needs to devote a lot more attention to New Zealand, to Australia, to South Pacific. So it's only a process that has begun. And I would say in the next 20 years, you see India's profile, India's engagement can only grow. And then you have the conflict which you talked about, the potential, how do we organize a new security system?
Yeah.
In this different context, that is going to be the biggest challenge.
And the United States has to be part of that.
Absolutely. No, no, and I think Indians have emphasized very clearly it has to be an inclusive system.
Yes. And that makes it a lot easier for Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah. Yeah.
With our residual affection in that context for the United States.
Absolutely. And I think the improved India-US relationship, India is now sees US as a resident power in Asia. And the US has begun to see, look, India must play a larger role in East Asia and the Pacific. So our interests are beginning to converge. The only thing we need is be careful not to scare off the Chinese and saying, look, this is some kind of a counter-containment.
And that's what people forget, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're playing. We are a mouse surrounded by elephants, and we must get along with them all.
No, I think I find New Zealand, I mean, being here for the last 5 weeks, it's become like India in the 50s, I mean, in the 60s. This emphasis on autonomy or independent foreign policy, and that you can opt out of the changing.
You'd almost call us non-aligned.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very much like that.
Really? But,
yeah, because, you know,
interesting it strikes you that way.
In a sense, we have traded places, you know. But my own argument here has been with friends that, look, New Zealand cannot opt out. New Zealand cannot believe that if you're nice to everyone, you'll not be affected by circumstances. That's exactly what Nehru thought.
Yes, and yet we see ourselves and regard our foreign policy as being extremely inclusive, being involved as widely as we can,
but it also
and standing
must,
for a few core values.
Yeah, that's where it must make some judgments in terms of you need to be part of a wider coalition,
yeah,
a coalition that includes US, India, Japan and Australia.
I would like to explore this with you further, but we've run out of time. Nice to talk to you. That was Dr. Raja Mohan, Victoria University's Kippenberger Fellow. He's also the Strategic Affairs Editor of the Indian Express in New Delhi, and you can read his stuff if you go to the Indian Express website.